I will beg if I have to, but please, people, some days, like today, you gotta look beyond the flashy headlines for the news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 21st of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, politics. I get it. I follow it too. Big stories today. But believe me when I tell you that it's the economic news of this Tuesday that is going to be with us for a while. There is trade. We'll get to that in a bit. We're going to do interest rates as well. But we begin with the American regulatory economy. The Environmental Protection Agency released details today of its plan to relax Obama-era rules about carbon emissions from power plants, coal-fired power plants in particular. President Trump ran to some degree and won on a promise to end what he calls the war on coal. And these rules proposed today are a long way from taking effect. But market forces are going to get a vote. Marketplace's Jed Kim gets us going.
The coal industry disliked the Clean Power Plan. It introduced emission caps for states and would have pushed them towards greener sources of energy. Several states sued. The plan never went into effect. Still, the threat was there. Brendan Collins is an environmental litigator for the law firm Ballard Spahr.
The Clean Power Plan did impose some burden on coal-fired power plants. It would have made them less economically competitive and therefore more likely to close.
So, since the new plan would strip away many of the major requirements for coal plants, it'd be a new dawn for the industry, right?
Nope, probably not.
Ethan Zindler is with Bloomberg NEF. He says regulations have not been the real threat to coal.
The single biggest factor that is leading to the demise of coal power in the United States is cheap gas, number one, followed by cheap renewables.
Zindler says natural gas prices would have to double in order for coal to be competitive. But while market forces have proven more powerful in driving down coal's use, regulations could help keep it around. Dan Lashoff is with the World Resources Institute. He says the administration is considering requiring some coal plants to keep running for national security reasons.
They're making a number of different moves to actually attempt to override market forces in order to slow down the phase out of coal-fired power in the United States.
The EPA's proposals still face a long process before they're approved. Environmental groups have already promised to sue to keep them from taking effect. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We're going to double back to the end of the program yesterday here for a second. That thing I mentioned about President Trump saying he is not thrilled with Fed Chairman Jay Powell and raising interest rates. This incumbent, like most other presidents, perhaps more actually, given his real estate background, likes money to be cheap. The wheels for businesses getting greased and all that. And that's the way it's been in this economy for a very long time, low interest rates. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, there are some costly downsides to keeping interest rates too low for too long, no matter what the president believes.
The economy's growth over the last decade has been fueled in large part by cheap money, thanks to the Fed's super low interest rate policy. That's just the kind of economy the president as businessman has thrived in, says Swarthmore College economist Mark Cooperberg.
Donald Trump has the mindset of a real estate developer that you can't have too big a boom. But standard macroeconomics says, no, you could have too big a boom.
And that's the risk posed by low interest rates going forward, says George Rusnak at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
The economy running too hot, and that would be a negative for everybody.
Negative consequence number one?
Inflation can pick up. It doesn't matter how fast we're growing, the costs of things grow faster. Two, easy money allows people to invest more aggressively. It could lead to investment speculation and bubbles.
Like the housing bubble that burst and brought on the Great Recession. Low interest rates have another downside. Savings accounts don't pay a very good return. That hurts retirees especially. And cheap money has also encouraged risky behavior in an entire generation of working-age consumers, says Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
They don't really mind borrowing money or using up their credit card. And in fact, household debt is at a record high level, primarily because the cost of borrowing has been so cheap.
Baumol says we have to break the cheap money habit so we can be prepared for tougher economic times to come. And he says the Fed needs to raise interest rates now so it can be ready to lower them again when the next recession rolls around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, on the eve of marking the longest bull market ever, traders were bullish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. a thought here for Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, if you would, or more accurately, for the dedicated career civil servants in the Department of Commerce who are having to execute on the administration's trade policy, tariffs in particular. Ross said this morning he is pushing back his end-of-this-month deadline for those automobile tariffs the president keeps talking about because, and this is a quote from Ross, "We just received elaborate questionnaires from the car companies," he said, "with zillions of pages, and that won't be ready in 5 minutes. We're running out of August," end of quote. And that's true. It has been busy. There's a Chinese trade delegation in town. NAFTA is supposed to be wrapped up any day now. And a boatload of businesses and trade groups are testifying in front of the U.S. Trade Representative about Chinese tariffs this week. Our tariffs on Chinese goods, I should say. Ann Wilson, the Senior Vice President for Government Relations at the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association, is up in front of the USTR on Thursday. Ms. Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Were you surprised at Secretary Ross's decision this morning to push back this timeline on the car tariffs?
Well, I'd say we were very pleased with the decision of the secretary. We've been very concerned about a couple of things. One is the amount of information that the Department of Commerce has received is going to take time to go through. And then secondly, I think the other concern that everybody needs to have is the impact that this is going to have on the economy overall. And I think the more time that Commerce takes to look at this, the more time the administration considers the employment and the cost implications of a tariff, the better decision we may get at the end.
Can I ask you just a daily life in the office question? I mean, we in the news business are our heads are spinning every time we turn around with new tariffs and whatnot. What's it like trying to manage your slice of trade policy and your members' interests when every day brings a new thing?
I think one of the things that has puzzled our members is why this administration is really focused on the auto industry. Our jobs have grown over the last 5 years. We are investing more in the U.S. We have new technology that we're putting on vehicles every day. And so it's really a questionable, why focus on us? Why put all these punitive tariffs on both consumers and the auto industry overall?
Let me ask you your own question, though. Why do you suppose the president dangles automobile tariffs on a fairly regular basis?
Well, I do think, you know, when you purchase a vehicle, it's the second largest purchase that most people make. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about the global supply chain and the impact that has on U.S. workers. But what we're trying to make sure that people understand, there are a lot of good jobs in the U.S. and that what we should be trying to do is focus on how we retain those jobs and grow those jobs in our country rather than just trying to sort of put the flour back in the bag and get jobs back here that we haven't had in decades.
What's your general level of hopefulness about trade in this economy?
I am cautiously pessimistic. I think there's an opportunity for us to work our way through this and come up with better trade agreements. But if we continue to add tariff upon tariff on imported goods, we're going to find investment leave this country. We're not going to grow jobs. And we're going to find ourselves at the losing end of new technology.
Ann Wilson, she is the Senior Vice President for Government Relations at the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association, testifying, I guess, Thursday, right, in front of the U.S. Trade Representative. Thanks very much for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You know, sometimes when a story's got as many twists and turns as this tariff story has, you just want to go with what you know. So we did. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. We call her up from time to time, including, obviously, today. Lisa, good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you, Kai.
So we had you on in April after not long after the tariffs went into effect. You said life was pretty good. Prices had gone up. You were doing well. How are we now, what, 6-7 months later?
I would say pretty much about the same. The last couple weeks, we've seen a slowdown, some of that seasonality, and some of it is kind of the reality of the new reality setting in.
Well, I don't even know what that means, the reality of the new reality. Help me understand that.
Well, usually when tariffs or other instruments go into place, you have time to go to the bank to ask for money. You don't want to go to the bank after you need the money. You try to go to the bank before you need it. So now you've been paying for steel for a couple of months at a lot bigger prices. You're waiting to get paid by your customers, and cash is tight for a lot of people.
So there's an inventory question I want to ask you as well, too, right? You were able to buy a bunch of stuff cheap-ish and then sell it for expensive, sell it for high. What do you do now if you need to build up your inventory, though?
Well, I've been sort of in a maintaining inventory mode, and we've been able to pass on the increases for the most part. And I think that that's kind of coming to an end, and narrower margins are around the corner.
Can this last, do you think? I mean, even the reality of the new reality and whatever, can the current situation endure?
Tariffs at 25% cannot endure. It's not a way to operate in an international global community. I think that something else is going to emerge as we begin to negotiate NAFTA and some other agreements. Some of this will not need to endure. And as I've kind of been telling people, the tariffs were put in place across the board very dramatically and aggressively, though our relationships are really different. You don't treat a sibling the way you treat a neighbor, the way you treat a casual acquaintance.
Even though they were, as we've agreed, haphazardly put into place, do you agree with the fact of the tariffs to begin with? Do you think they were necessary?
Like you would do anything for your spouse or your kid, I would do anything for American manufacturing. I believe in it wholeheartedly, and I want to give it the best advantage possible. This particular president is determined to create a much more fair playing field, and I commend that. I really do. I don't necessarily agree with the style, the direction, but something had to be done. So, yes, I am a supporter. If your trade partners are not fair and equal, then we ought to negotiate for our own behalf and not necessarily only the greater good. I think where we've gotten ourselves into trouble is we've put others ahead of ourselves and been sort of like the benevolent party at the table looking to care for all members and not taking good enough care of ourselves.
Lisa Goldenberg, president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. Lisa, thanks a lot. Always good to talk to you.
You bet. Anytime, Kai. Take care.
The immigration debate in this country focuses a lot on what happens at the border, the southern border, to be precise. There's going to be a political change in Mexico later this year that could affect what happens at that U.S.-Mexican border. Andrés Manuel López Obrador takes office in December, and he's already been in touch with President Trump about migrants, specifically migrants from other Latin American countries who pass through Mexico on their way north. From the Mexico City Bureau of KJZZ, Jorge Valencia reports.
Victor Muñoz is a 26-year-old from coastal Honduras who wants to make his way to the U.S. One of his stops is here in Mexico City. The goal, he says, is to join his brother in Texas. Muñoz grew up in the northern Honduran town of Puerto Cortes, where violence is a part of daily life. He tells the story of his father's murder a few blocks from home on Christmas Eve.
I was with my girlfriend and her family, and by the time I found out and went looking for my father, I found him lifeless on the ground.
Muñoz says the assailants robbed the mechanic shop where his father worked. He says they were members of the 18th Street gang and eventually came looking for him too. He has the scars to prove it.
I was walking about a half block from my house when they attacked me. One of them attacked me, cut the palm of my hand, my fingers, and my arm. I went to the hospital and then I left the country because otherwise they said they were going to kill me.
Mexico's incoming president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, wants people like Muñoz to safely stay in their home countries. For that to happen, they need economic opportunity. So López Obrador wrote to President Donald Trump saying he'll ask the Mexican Congress to fund economic development in Central America. Trump replied that he's willing to discuss development, but his priority is that the sovereignty of both countries is protected. In other words, the borders. Gabriela Cuevas is a member of the Mexican Congress. Like López Obrador, she wants to see fewer people leaving Mexico and Central America for the U.S.
We want to give them all the opportunities, and so does Donald Trump. So we can have some kind of agreements.
Mexico has a long history of stopping migrants from other countries before they reach the U.S. That's thanks in part to immigration enforcement funded by the U.S. and something known as the Southern Border Plan. In the last 4 years, Mexico has deported about 500,000 people back to their home countries in Central America.
Yes, my name is Delia Arias.
Arias volunteers at a shelter in Mexico City, helping migrants fill out forms and going with them to the local immigration office. She's also a student at the Columbia Law School in New York.
If you go ahead and read immigration law of Mexico, it's beautiful.
What Arias means is that on paper, Mexico provides many protections for migrants. But in practice, authorities often neglect and even mistreat them. The Mexican government's Human Rights Commission has documented hundreds of complaints of police extortion and assault.
We don't have a lot of follow-through in Mexico often, and I think that's the root cause of a lot of our problems.
Victor Munoz, the 26-year-old from Honduras, laughs at the idea of Mexico promoting development in his home country and the rest of Central America.
But the gangs are already there. The cartels are already there. And people like me, you can't really make it safe for us to return anymore.
Munoz says he doesn't have many options. He says he'll look for work in Mexico, or he'll travel to the border with Texas and apply for asylum in the U.S. In Mexico City, I'm Jorge Valencia for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I've put about $6,000 to $7,000 in, and I've gotten probably close to $100,000 out.
Making new money out of old memories. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 63 points today, 0.2%, closed at 25,822. The Nasdaq gained 38 points, 0.4%, 7,859. S&P 500 closed up 5 points, 0.2%, 2,862. The S&P's bull market run now is 3,452 days old. That ties a record, which will be broken tomorrow, unless, of course, the S&P falls 21%, I'm just saying. Shares of online trading companies dipped after news that J.P. Morgan's going to offer a new digital investment app with free trading. See the above-mentioned 21% fall. Charles Schwab fell 2.4%. Today, TD Ameritrade dropped 0.7%. Shares of the department store Kohl's rose 1.7%. Today, posted quarterly earnings and same-store sales above estimates. Raised its full-year profit forecast as well. You're listening to Marketplace. Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. According to the International Maritime Organization, that's a part of the United Nations, 90% of global trade gets where it's going by sea. Which is, by way of a slightly long windup, why this next item caught our eye. Next month, the international shipping conglomerate Maersk is going to launch the first container ship to go on an Arctic Ocean route. It will go from Vladivostok on the Pacific Ocean in eastern Russia all the way up and over to St. Petersburg on the Gulf of Finland. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein makes the economic case.
With the voyage of the Venta Maersk, the Danish shipping giant is testing the rapidly warming waters of the Arctic, looking for a shortcut between Europe and Asia.
There has been shipping through the Northern Sea Route for the better part of a century, but it was unpredictable and it required ice-breaking assistance.
University of British Columbia's Michael Byer says sending a ship loaded with containers, that is uncharted territory.
And all those problems meant that shipping companies couldn't be certain that their containers would get to their destinations on time. And that's what's changing, that just-in-time shipping is now foreseeable within the next decade.
A northern passage could cut fuel costs and travel time, but Lars Jensen of consulting firm Sea Intelligence says for Arctic shipping, you need expensive ships that can break ice and a bunch of insurance.
From the perspective of going north of Siberia, settlements are very small and very far in between. You have a big problem if something goes wrong.
Still, shipping in the Arctic has only grown over the last decade, and that is great news for one country in particular, says Malte Humpert with the Arctic Institute.
Russia has to look to oil and gas in the Arctic, and the only way to get this oil and gas out of the Arctic is to use the shipping route.
The Venta Maersk, packed with frozen fish, is due in port sometime towards the end of September. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
For those of you out there who know the Brady Bunch, and if you don't, think iconic early 1970s family-style sitcom, this next item is going to strike a chord. That house you always saw in the exterior shots sold a couple of weeks ago for $3.5 million. HGTV, the Home Improvement Channel, was the buyer, presumably for economic gain. As Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, the Brady House is just one example of how classic sitcoms are still making money for somebody after all these years.
The year is 1999. The setting? A living room in Miami. 15-year-old Alexander Ruche is walking to the kitchen to get a glass of water when his mom calls him over to the couch. I Love Lucy is on TV. She wants him to watch with her. And he's like, Mom, nah, this thing's in black and white.
And she tells me, you know, hey, give it a chance. It's actually pretty funny.
In the episode, Lucy gets suckered into buying a vacuum cleaner from a door-to-door salesman. Her husband, Ricky, played by Desi Arnaz, comes home and finds it in a closet.
Oh, darn, you found your Christmas present.
The handy-dandy vacuum cleaner. Oh, no, Lucy.
As soon as I heard the accent, you know, I was like, this guy's Cuban. So coming from a Cuban background myself, you know, I was intrigued.
Ruche fell in love with the show. Soon he was buying collectibles, like autographed photos of Lucy and Desi. And then he turned from buyer to seller. He started a website that sells secondhand I Love Lucy memorabilia, vintage Christmas ornaments, puzzles, props from the set.
I've put about probably $6,000 to $7,000 in, and I've gotten probably close to $100,000 out.
There are lots of websites like Ruche's. They sell I Dream of Jeannie calendars, Bewitched comic books, and these decades-old sitcoms still have devoted fans who are buying this stuff. That's because these shows never really went away. First, they stayed alive through reruns. Then, in 1985, they got a boost when Nickelodeon created a primetime block of oldies television.
It's Nick at Night. Makes the world seem bright.
Nick at Night played nothing but 1950s and 60s reruns, like The Donna Reed Show and Mr. Ed. Fred Seibert is one of the guys who pitched the idea.
We thought this was a no-brainer. Oldies radio had worked. Why wouldn't oldies television work?
Some of the network's executives were skeptical. Reruns weren't exactly exciting.
It was like, oh, God, reruns. I said, no, 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 reruns. Oh, boy, reruns.
Nick at Night was a hit. And soon it added more shows to the lineup, like I Love Lucy, Bewitched, and The Brady Bunch.
Here's the story of a lovely lady.
Its success led to more retro programming. Networks like TV Land and MeTV, they kept these shows alive. Now it's easier than ever to watch classic TV shows on streaming services like Hulu and Netflix. And the networks that own the rights to these shows are still cranking out merchandise. Like CBS, it just launched a Brady Bunch board game and Lucy figurines. Veronica Hart runs the network's licensing division. She says lately they've been marketing Lucille Ball as an icon. She was a pioneer, a working mother who ran a primetime show in the 50s.
All of that's still very relevant today, and we're seeing that young women in particular are gravitating towards her because of that.
In 2012, the network CEO said I Love Lucy earned CBS $20 million a year. I Love Lucy superfan Alexander Ruche hasn't made that much, but he's doing all right.
Lucy paid for the down payment on my house, and Lucy paid for my wedding, and Lucy's never even met me.
There are some Lucy collectibles Ruche won't sell, like one of his favorite pieces, the rotary phone used in the show. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick coda to Jed's story on the economics of President Trump's coal plan. There is the global warming angle, of course. Also this, according to the EPA's own estimates, there would be between 470 and 1,400 additional premature annual deaths by the year 2030 under its new coal plant regulations. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 63 points today, 0.2%. NASDAQ up 38 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 closed up 5 points, about 0.2%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.